The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make The Sewers of Paris possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. This week's guest is John Epperson, also known by his stage name Lipsinka, who you might have seen in the documentary Wigstock, in the movie Black Swan, and also gracing New York stages from the legendary Pyramid Club to Lincoln Center. John moved from small-town Mississippi to New York to chase a dream of a life in the theater, and found fame with his drag alter ego in the wild 1970s and 80s, all while awash in radical, revolutionary queer culture of the East Village. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that I've got a little newsletter where I share sneak peeks at what I'm working on next. The most recent newsletter featured a recommendation for a fascinating documentary on the history of Nickelodeon that featured prominently in my latest YouTube video. Sign up for my newsletter at mattbaum.com. Also, speaking of the history of Nickelodeon and my YouTube videos, check out my YouTube channel for deep dives into queer pop culture history. My latest video is all about Rocco's modern life and the secret gay history of 90s animation. That's at youtube.com/mattbaum. Also, a big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon, and to everyone who's reviewed it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's John. Well, this week I'm speaking with John Epperson, a.k.a. Lipsinka. Thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
So, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, there's not just one thing, I don't suppose. I didn't have access to live theater when I was a kid, but I certainly had access to movies and television.
Okay.
And I feel like the first movie I may have been taken to see, although I don't suppose it really was, but it's the one I remember. It must have been in 60 or 61 at a drive-in movie theater in Brookhaven, Mississippi, to see Psycho, the Alfred Hitchcock movie. I think my mother was very reluctant because she knew what the movie was about, but my father was determined. And my mother has said since then that she was relieved that one of my sisters and I fell asleep before before Janet Leigh was murdered. So we were spared that.
So you missed the big moment.
So I didn't see that until I think the movie was re-released in 1967. And it played the town where I grew up, Hazelhurst, Mississippi, and it played a whole weekend, and I think I went to every screening of it because by then I was a real movie buff.
Did that tend to be how you, I guess, consumed or saw movies at the time? Like, was it usually at a drive-in or on the big screen?
Could have been on television, too. I guess we saw movies on television. But it was, you know, people still went out to the movies then, and they went to drive-ins. And that was fun to do. So there was a movie theater in the town where I grew up, Hazelhurst, as I mentioned earlier. And two important movies, I guess they were seminal movies for me in 1962, were Bye Bye Birdie and Gypsy, both of which now I find disappointing because I think they're not as directed as they could have been. But as a seven-year-old, those movies packed a wallop, especially Gypsy, because it was about stripping, and I knew what that was at age seven. And I was afraid that I was going to have to convince my mother to let me go and see it because of the subject matter. But she had seen it, and I guess she thought it was harmless. And I did see that, and I loved it. But like I said, now I sit and watch it, and I pick it apart, and think, why did they do that? And that's kind of messy, and that's kind of dull. But once they hit that burlesque house in the last third of the movie, it's smooth sailing. You can't go wrong. And I'm not blaming the material. I'm just saying it's not, in my opinion, directed well enough.
Was there, you know, Gypsy is one of those movies that I think of, you know, in the same sort of vein as Mame, where there's just a really such a larger than life female lead. Was that something that was exciting to you? Were you one of those young queer children who was gravitated towards those sorts of roles?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. And not just Rosalind Russell, but Natalie Wood, too, because she was the sexy one. She was the vulnerable one. She's the one who turns out has some talent.
Were there characters like maybe even Natalie Wood's character? Were there characters that you felt that you identified with?
Well, a theory that I have about movie stars like Rosalind Russell and Natalie Wood and Anne Margaret, and why I'm not even sure queer people is the right word. I don't even identify as gay any longer. I think gay and straight are outmoded labels. And for all I know, queer is an outmoded label. But for people who felt like outsiders, like I did, let's put it that way, misfits, aliens, I was drawn to women like that because I think I must have subconsciously thought that they were the other also. For instance, Judy Garland was obviously a very talented person, and that talent makes her the other. That's a very unusual talent. And I guess I felt like the other, and so I responded to these people because subliminally I must have felt that they were the other too, based on their talent or their beauty or their sexiness or their vulnerability.
What were the things that made you feel like another?
Well, I didn't enjoy doing things that other boys did. I was called a sissy. I liked to play with my sister's dolls. I liked to play the piano. I was not interested in sports. My father was interested in sports. I was his only son. It was pretty obvious he was disappointed that I had no affinity for it. It's a classic story.
Yeah, I think you said you were growing up in Mississippi, right?
Yes.
That must have been a difficult place to connect with other folks who were outside of what was expected of boys.
Well, it was. Was it any different in New York City? I don't know. I think expectations of a child are probably difficult anywhere, anytime. Childhood is not an easy time.
Did you have outlets for other interests, you know, the stuff that you did like?
Well, I was allowed to start taking piano lessons, private piano lessons, I think when I was 10 years old. My two sisters were older than me, and at an early age, I announced to my parents that I wanted to study the piano. And my father said, "I've already got two piano players." But then he said I could start at 10. I guess I was attempting it even before then. And there was a school play every year once I was in school, but it was mostly just living in my head. That was my main outlet.
What were the fantasies, I guess, or like where did you like to go in your head?
Oh, I would pretend that I would be a movie star someday, which now I see as a very unhealthy thing. But probably at that time, a very common thing, and may still be common for kids to fantasize that that will happen for them. So I kind of made that happen for myself by creating Lipsinka, who's a star.
Yeah, we should talk about Lipsinka a little bit. I know that's skipping like way ahead from childhood to New York City, but tell me about Lipsinka's genesis and how that character came to you.
Well, it's not that far off from my childhood. My father had a record album when we were kids. So my oldest sister was she was 7 years older than me. And then there's another sister between the two of us. And my father had this album called For Men Only. And it had on the cover a picture of Jane Mansfield wearing a black cat suit on all fours, looking up at the camera. Now, Jane Mansfield is not singing on the album. She's just the model on the cover.
Oh, okay.
Jane Mansfield modeled for a lot of record album covers and magazine covers. And the songs on the recording have a lot of women singing songs that were hits in the 50s. And my sisters would put the record on and they would pretend to be singing the songs by moving their lips to the female singers on the record. And my mother and I were the audience. And my mother called it pantomime. She didn't call it lip syncing, but that's what they were doing. They were synchronizing their mouths to the singers on the record.
I'm so delighted that your sisters kind of invented, without realizing, invented lip syncing in the household.
Yeah, I don't think my oldest sister had ever seen anyone do that before, or knew she was seeing that. Of course, people in movies are lip syncing all the time, but you know, we're not told what the behind the scenes illusion is as kids. So I wanted to be able to do that too, and I attempted it. And I, you know, saw that they were getting attention by doing it. And I think I wanted to be noticed too. What does Rose say in Gypsy? The daughter says to her mother, "Why did you do it, Mama?" And Rose says, "I guess I just wanted to be noticed." Well, we all want to be noticed. Even if we're not in show business, we want to be noticed. We want our boss to say we did a good job. So I think my desire to be a performer was just simply that. I wanted to be noticed.
What are the songs that you started lip-syncing to? And when did you start lip-syncing?
Well, like I said, when I was a kid, I would emulate my sisters and I would lip-sync to that record too. I remember doing it once at a family reunion and everyone gathering around and applauding me. And so I got the attention that I wanted. I did get noticed. My father was probably horrified. But even when I did my very first public lip-syncing performance as an adult in the summer of 1980, I used that record. I used one of the songs from that record. Last time I checked, it is on YouTube. And the song that I used is called Pepper Hot Baby. And someone just sent me a link on YouTube of a performance I did in 1990 in Los Angeles, and I still use that song. And maybe I'll use it again someday.
What was it that got you to make the leap from performing for family and just doing it for fun to performing? You said it was 1980, I think, was the first performance, public?
Yes.
What were the circumstances for going public?
Well, even if you get noticed, you want to be more noticed, right? You want it more and more and more and more. It's almost like a drug, applause and attention, until some people, of course, they get enough and they're no longer stage starved and they stop. But I wanted to make my mark. I wanted to come to New York and do something unique and unusual. And when I got to college, I should backtrack. So I said that when I was in elementary school, grammar school, there was a school play, but there was no school play in junior high or high school. So it wasn't until I got to college that I got to the chance to be in a stage musical. And I auditioned for the show that year. It was Once Upon a Mattress. And I got cast in the chorus. But honestly, anyone who auditioned would have been cast because they needed people to be in the show. And I got laughs. And that's when I realized that I had the ability to entertain people and make them laugh. And then the next year, we did Bye Bye Birdie. And I was cast as in the lead, the Dick Van Dyke role. I'm sorry. No, the second year, we did The Boyfriend. And I had the lead in that. And then we did Bye Bye Birdie. And I had the lead in that. And then my senior year, we did not have a musical. But by then, I was totally hooked on theater. And I had seen professional and semi-professional theater. And I came to New York, my very first trip to New York, and my very first trip on an airplane was the summer of 1975. And, you know, I got here and I realized, oh yeah, this is the place for me. I didn't move here until 78, but the seed was planted.
Do you remember like what you saw that made you realize that you needed to be in New York?
Well, I can tell you what I saw before I got to New York. I mentioned that I had seen some professional theater. I started to notice around 1969 in the newspaper, because the small town I lived in is only 30 miles from Jackson, which is the capital of the state. It's the biggest city in Mississippi. And I started noticing that there were ads for road shows, professional road shows that were coming through town. But they only played one night, so it was a bus and truck one-night stand road tour of a Broadway show. And I noticed there was an ad for Plaza Suite, the Neil Simon play, starring two people that I had never heard of, Betty Garrett and her husband, Larry Parks. Mm-hmm. And I said to my mother, well, why don't we go and see that? And my mother was up for adventure then. She liked to go and do things. And so we went and we saw it. And I think my mother knew the name Neil Simon, the author of the play. Mm-hmm. And she probably knew who Betty Garrett and Larry Parks were from her own youth, because Betty Garrett was a star at MGM in the 40s. What I didn't know, and maybe my mother didn't know it either, was that the two of them had been blacklisted during the communist witch hunt in the 50s.
Oh.
So there they were going through the South, mm-hmm. and doing this Neil Simon play, a play by a New York Jew. But she enjoyed it, and I did too. That was my first taste of professional theater. And she and I started to go see more of those shows. We saw Company, the Sondheim musical, also played only for one night. And it wasn't Elaine Stritch in the famous role. It was Julie Wilson. Mm-hmm. And so that was 71 when we saw Company. And then I went to school. I went off to college in 72. And then I would go to see the road shows by myself, because I was there living. I was going to college in Jackson. And I then said to my mother in 75, I said, well, it's fine to go and see these shows in Jackson, but I want to go and see these shows in the place where they start. I want to go to New York City. And she said, well, you're not going without me. That mainly because probably she didn't want me to go alone, but she also wanted to go too. So our first trip to New York, first time on an airplane, and we had tickets for a few plays. We had tickets to see Ellen Burstyn and Charles Grodin in a comedy called Same Time Next Year. And Charles Grodin just died recently, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we saw a play called Absurd Person Singular with Geraldine Page. First thing we saw was a musical. It was the Harold Prince environmental production of Candide, which we did not like, in part because we preferred proscenium theater. We didn't care for the environmental theater.
Yeah, what does that mean? Environmental production of Candide. What were you actually seeing?
Well, it was in the Broadway theater, and that's the name of the theater. I don't mean a Broadway theater. I mean the Broadway theater where Gypsy played. Mm-hmm. That's the name of the theater, and they changed the seating around so it wasn't a proscenium stage. It wasn't traditional theater seating. The seating was all over the place, and the playing area was all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to follow. So we didn't like that. But I'm getting to the good part. So we did see the Ritz. Rita Moreno is no longer in it, but some of the other originals were in it. And my mother enjoyed that, to my surprise. We saw Equus, which she did not like because it had sex and nudity in it and violence.
Yeah, I was going to say, what did you see with your mother?
Well, I picked all the shows, not her. But now looking back, I don't think Equus is that great myself. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I really thought I was seeing something important. But the only... other than Candide, the only Broadway musical we saw was Chicago, the original production of Chicago with Gwen Verdon and Cheetah Rivera. However, when we arrived, my mother picked up the newspaper here, the New York Times, and there was an announcement that Cheetah Rivera had left the show for 3 weeks and that Liza Minnelli had replaced her. And that's who I saw play Roxy Hart.
Wow, how was that?
Well, the show was fantastic, and I'm supposing that Liza was wonderful too, and certainly Cheetah was, but in a way, I was a little disappointed because 2 years before that, I had seen Liza from the front row in her own concert in Baton Rouge, only a year after Liza with a Z and Cabaret. So that... to me, it was even more spectacular than seeing her in Chicago, the show Chicago on Broadway. Not saying it wasn't great to see that, it was. There was a great deal of excitement about that. And when we left the theater, Andy Warhol was on the sidewalk and I locked eyes with him because he had been to that performance also.
Gosh, you're just swimming in so many legends here. You'd seen so many incredible people at that point, and you hadn't even moved to New York yet.
Well, before we left for that trip, I realized that we didn't have a ticket to see an off-Broadway show. So I went back probably to the New York Times to look and see what might be available off-Broadway. And I saw an ad for a show, and I liked the ad. I liked the title, and I sent the money for the tickets. I don't know if I sent a check or cash, but the tickets came back with a note. And the note said, "This show is no longer playing at the Public Theater on Lafayette Street. It is now playing at the Schubert Theater on West 44th Street. Ticket price didn't change. And here are your tickets." And that is how my mother and I walked into a preview of a chorus line, and we didn't even know what we were walking into.
Oh my gosh. You know, with how gigantic and corporate Broadway musicals can be today, it's just kind of amazing that, you know, the idea of somebody just flipping to a page in a newspaper, you know, several states away and just plopping down some money to see whatever they see, like to walk into a preview of a chorus line is just kind of astounding.
Yeah, and I can't think of anything that I want to rush and see on Broadway now.
So you moved to New York in 78. How did that compare to being a, you know, visiting versus living there?
Well, it was a little scary because now I have to fend for myself here, right? On the other hand, I was only 23, and when you're that young, you're not totally sure what fear is. It had to be somewhat fearless. And then the trip as a tourist, there was some fear also because we thought the taxi driver might take us way out of the way, or, you know, we didn't know what to expect from anyone. But like I said, I was 23, and I had found a place to live, and I lived there with two friends who had from Mississippi also, and they had arrived 3 weeks before I did. And they had been living in a transient hotel way down on East 28th Street for those 3 weeks. And then when I arrived, the three of us moved together into a better neighborhood, at that time, a much better neighborhood, on the Upper West Side, a place called the Coliseum House, also a transient hotel, on 71st between the big intersection of Broadway and Amsterdam, and the other end of the block was West End Avenue. So it was a lot closer to grocery stores and to the subway and to Lincoln Center and to the places where I hoped to work and did end up working. And I started getting jobs as a pianist for the ballet, which is what I had been doing in Mississippi.
Yeah. So what was the plan? You said there were places that you hoped to work. So what were your aspirations as a fresh arrival in New York?
Well, when I was in college, I was working, making some money in Mississippi, playing the piano for singers at their singing lessons. And then I started playing at the ballet school there. Mm-hmm. And I made money that way. And from 77 to 78, I worked there full time at the ballet company there. And that's how I saved the money to put aside to move to New York. And during that year, some things happened while I was still in Mississippi. One thing that happened was at Christmas time on PBS, Baryshnikov and Gelsey Kirkland danced the Nutcracker. And I saw that. And they were at American Ballet Theater along with everyone else in the film on PBS, the Nutcracker film. And I thought, well, if I'm going to get to New York, it sure would be interesting to work with artists like that. And then a few months later, also on PBS, there was a Live from Lincoln Center performance of American Ballet Theater. The Nutcracker was not live. That was filmed in a studio. So now this other television event I'm describing was live. And my friends and I saw that. And once again, Misha Baryshnikov and Gelsey Kirkland danced together, not the Nutcracker, though. They danced a Balanchine ballet called Theme and Variations. And then after that, someone interviewed Kirkland on camera. And that made me think more than ever that I wanted to work with people like that. And then around the same time, a movie came to Jackson, a new film called The Turning Point, which Baryshnikov was in. And it's about a ballet company. And Herbert Ross, the director, had been a dancer at American Ballet Theater. And his wife, Nora Kay, had been a dancer at American Ballet Theater, and she was the producer of the movie. And the movie was a big hit. Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft were the stars. They played ballet dancers. Bancroft's character was still dancing, and Shirley MacLaine's character had stopped. And they used a lot of people from American Ballet Theater. And I thought to myself, if I could get to New York and get a job in American Ballet Theater, maybe I would meet Herbert Ross, the director of The Turning Point, and he would put me in the movies. And so when I got to New York in 78, American Ballet Theater's offices is the first place I went to get a job. And I did get a little job there, and the job grew, and it grew for a couple of years. And I started playing class for the company, and then I started playing rehearsals on an hourly basis. And then in 1980, when Baryshnikov became the director of the company, I joined as a full-time member of the company myself as a rehearsal pianist.
What was it? Did you feel like, okay, this is it, I'm making it?
Well, I certainly felt that I achieved this one goal that I set for myself, which was to be a full-time rehearsal pianist at American Ballet Theater and work with all the great dancers and travel with them. And I enjoyed that for a few years. And then I started to realize that the ceiling on that job was pretty low. Mm-hmm. And I had other aspirations. I wanted to be on stage too. I didn't want to be playing for other people to be on stage. And I started my Lipsinka career, and that started building and really started to get some attention in 1985. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started thinking, well, how can I segue out of this job and do Lipsinka as a job? But I didn't do that until 1991.
What do you remember from like the first time that you performed as Lipsinka? Like where did that happen and what did it feel like?
Well, I don't remember the first time that I performed using the name Lipsinka. I do remember the first time I did my pup. As I mentioned earlier, I used one of those songs from my father's record album when I did my very first public lip syncing. But at that time, I hadn't come up with the name and the concept of Lipsinka. And that didn't come to me until 1982. And I don't remember what the first performance was. Whatever it wasn't as exciting as I had hoped it would be. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure of that because I was still struggling to get an audience. And that changed in 1984. When I performed at the Pyramid Club for the first time. Sunday night was gay night there. At that time, the gay Sunday night was called Cafe Iguana. About a year later, they changed the name of gay Sunday night to Whispers, which they thought sounded like the name of a gay bar on Long Island, and they thought that was funny. So that's why they called it Whispers. The Sunday night at the Pyramid Club had a built-in audience, you see. The audience was going to come no matter who was up performing. Mm-hmm. And so when I performed there, they had never heard of me, the audience, but they liked what they saw. And that was the first time I really got the response that I had been looking for. And that's, like I said, it was addictive, and I wanted another booking the next month and another booking after that and another booking after that. And it started to build.
When you're performing as Lipsinka, I imagine it's quite different from just being on the piano. at least my expectation of that would be like, as an accompanist, you sort of need to blend in and not upstage the performer. And then when you're a lip-synca, it's very much about, you know, all eyes on you. Did it feel very different to be on stage in that persona?
Well, yeah, I'm sure. Yes, it did. Because there was one guy who used to work at American Ballet Theater who quit because he said, "I feel like the old guy in the corner." He was playing the piano for the dancers also. And so that's how he described the job. And so this didn't feel that way at all. This felt like, as that guy put it, he said, "I need to quit this job because I need some rock star in my life." Hmm. So yeah, I didn't feel like the old guy in the corner anymore. I felt like a rock star.
Where did that take you? Like you said, you started this one little bar where people were kind of showing up because they just were showing up. They weren't showing up for you. When did you start to notice that people were, that lip sync of the character was a hit?
Well, you said the words, "this one little bar," which makes me think that you have not heard of the Pyramid Club. Is that?
No, I am not familiar.
Okay. Well, it's a legendary place. And now people are starting to probably teach it in colleges. And even a couple of days ago, I got a letter from someone who wants to make yet another documentary about that place. Mm-hmm. So then you probably don't know that the East Village here in New York in the 1980s was a hotbed of activity, and all kinds of great things were happening. And Keith Haring had his first show, and Madonna performed at the Pyramid Club. So
were you like the?
I'm not putting you down by your saying this little bar, but it was really a hot spot. I began to realize it was the equivalent of what the Continental Baths must have been for Bette Midler when she started her career.
Wow. Okay. So you're actually like in the epicenter of a lot of creative work all happening at once. And did you feel like, I don't know, that the folks that you had previously looked up to were now your colleagues?
Are you talking about in the ballet world?
Well, or you know, you mentioned like all these creative folks who work in the East Village. And now you're starting to get a name as lip-synca there. You're not, like you said, the old man playing the piano in the kind of off in the distance in the corner.
Right. But you said something about people that I look up to are now mm-hmm. my colleagues. People in the East Village were, I'm not saying I looked down at them, but we were all equals in my eye. Mm.
What sort of, did you have like opportunities to expand and did you see your audience growing? Like, you know, you compared it to kind of Bette Midler in the Continental Baths. Did you start to obtain a following?
Yeah. So at first, like I said, the audience was going to come no matter what, but then it became apparent when I performed there that there were people who were coming specifically to see me. Mm-hmm. That became apparent to me. And I guess it became apparent to the management too.
What sort of shows were you like when someone shows up to one of these events, what did people see at one of your shows? Like what could they expect to see on stage?
From me? Mm-hmm. Well, at first it was very primitive. And I guess my lip syncing was good enough. And they were probably thought the name was funny, but I wasn't editing tape at the beginning. I was just lip syncing a song from beginning to end. And I think I had a lot of energy and I guess I was funny. I must have been funny. I hope I was. Mm-hmm. And must have seemed unique to them. I wanted it to seem unique. I had seen a lot of drag performers in Mississippi when I was in school, but they weren't, most of them were not funny. Most of them were very serious, kind of pageant queens. Mm. And I wanted to do something that was funnier than that. And I had hoped that it was unique and more unique than that. And I created the name Lip-synca because I wanted the audience to know. One of the reasons I created the name was because I wanted the audience to know that I had a sense of humor about what I was doing, that I thought it was a silly thing to do, but a worthy thing to do at the same time. And I felt it needed to be rooted in some kind of gay tradition, some kind of gay performance tradition, I mean. And that's when I thought of lip syncing, because that's mostly what, in fact, I think it's all they ever did at the drag club that I went to in Mississippi.
What were the...
I wanted to kind of lift that up and poke fun at it at the same time.
Mm. My understanding is that was sort of a renaissance time in New York through the 80s for a lot of drag performers who are, you know, still very like widely remembered right now. What do you remember from that time? It seems like it must have been a cauldron for people trying new stuff and getting bigger, and especially with Wigstock turning into a whole thing around that would have been the end of the 80s, I think?
Wigstock started in 1985.
Okay.
Well, some people have compared the East Village 80s scene to what Paris must have been like in the 20s, and that comparison may be apt. There were lots of things going on, as you said. A lot of people were trying things in performance and in art and filmmaking. And at Club 57, which was the precursor to the Pyramid Club, they showed movies there a lot. They showed movies at the Pyramid Club occasionally, but they showed a lot of movies at Club 57. And the first time I went there was to see a movie, was to see Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. There was no other place showing it. And this was kind of before home video, before videotapes could be purchased or rented.
Mm. Yeah, this would have been...
That's one of the reasons I was drawn to the East Village originally was because I'm a cinephile and I wanted to see that movie. That's mm-hmm. what got me there. And then when Club 57 closed, the Pyramid picked up the slack. Everybody shifted from Club 57 to the Pyramid Club.
Did you feel like you were... did you have a lot of inspiration happening around that time? Like you mentioned Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Was there other stuff as a cinephile that you're seeing that you like either wanted to incorporate into your act or you just found inspirational in some way?
Well, I was getting inspiration from all kinds of places because I wasn't limiting myself just to the East Village. The job at American Ballet Theater was downtown, except when we were at Lincoln Center at the Metropolitan Opera House. But I was always up at near Lincoln Center anyway, because there was a revival house that showed old movies. It was the best revival house in the city. It was called the Regency. And mm-hmm. I practically lived there seeing old movies that now are on Turner Classic Movies all the time. But at that time, there was no other way to see them. So I had a kind of double life, you know, because I had this high arts job at the ballet, and then I had this low arts job performing at the Pyramid Club.
Did you feel like a different person when you shifted from that, as you called it, the high arts job to the low arts job? Like, did you feel like you had two different personas?
Well, no. When I say I was leading a double life, I'm half joking. My interests and I guess my abilities run the gamut, you know. Then years later, I was in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella at Lincoln Center with Eartha Kitt, you know. But if I hadn't performed at the Pyramid Club, that might never have happened. Hmm. I might not have performed with Eartha Kitt at Lincoln Center if I hadn't started at the Pyramid Club.
That is pretty remarkable going from, I mean, you use the terms high culture and low culture, but it seems like there's probably a blurring process somewhere in the middle there. But
Bette Midler started at a bathhouse, and then she became a movie star because of that. Mm-hmm. So Barbra Streisand, her first public singing was at a talent show on 9th Street. And now she's practically a recluse in Malibu. So this is just what life does to people, some people.
Was it fulfilling? Like, did the work that you were doing as Lipsinka, I don't know. Like when you left a gig, how did you feel about the performances that you were doing?
Oh, well, it was for years, it was such an adrenaline high to do that. Mm-hmm. And mind you, the shows weren't until 1 o'clock in the morning. So by the time I got to bed, it could have been 4. Mm. And even then, if I did fall asleep, I didn't sleep for very long because I'd wake up and I'd remember what I had just done and the adrenaline was still pumping and I would lie in bed and think, well, what did I do that was good? What did I do that could be better? And unfortunately, live performance can still cause your adrenaline to pump and keep you from getting enough sleep.
Were there performances that stick with you as being particularly either ones that you're very proud of or just that were memorable? I imagine Lincoln Center was a big deal.
Well, certainly and that only ran for 3 weeks, but I milked every moment of that I could.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in the summer of 94, when the Gay Olympics was taking place here in the city, and I performed at Irving Plaza one night, one performance, and we didn't know if anyone was going to come, but they did. It was an enormous crowd, and I remember that being a very fun night, and I remember thinking to myself, I feel like Lena Horne, because I had seen Lena Horne's show on Broadway in 1981, and she was at a high standard that I set for myself. And I remember thinking in 94, well, this may be the closest you'll ever feel like you were connecting with an audience the way Lena Horne did that night that I saw her at the Nederlander Theater on Broadway. And then the next day I got on a plane and I flew to Los Angeles and made a film with the director Paul Schrader and the actor Dennis Hopper. So that was high living.
Mm-hmm. What do you have advice for folks who are coming up now? That kids who I say kids, but people in general who want to get into drag and performance and have dreams like you did of moving to New York.
Well, if you're going to move to New York, you should do it when you're young. I have friends in California, some who are alive, some who are not, who would say, I'm going to move to New York someday. And I would think to myself, no, you're not. You're just going to get comfortable in your 40s in California, and you're not ever going to make that move. My niece is in her 20s. She went to Interlochen and then to Webster University in St. Louis to study to be an actress. And her boyfriend is an actor. He went to Webster University also. They're young. They've moved here.
Mm-hmm.
They're living in New York. Of course, there's been nothing for them to do for over a year because there's been nothing for anyone to do.
Mm-hmm.
But they would want to live here anyway. They grew up in Georgia and Mississippi, so they would rather be here anyway, even if they aren't going to get acting gigs, I think. And hopefully they will. Hopefully there will be something for them and everyone else down the line sooner than later.
Yeah, it does seem like...
I wouldn't recommend coming to New York right now, except rents may be lower because they need people. But those rents are going to go up. The rents, if the rents are lowered, it's probably because the apartment is not rent regulated. And that means the landlord can then raise the rent if it's not rent regulated. My niece, however, has found a rent regulated apartment. I don't know how many there are available right now, but they were probably more readily available a year ago.
Is there advice that you would have given the young you, like, looking back to when, this decades ago when you were thinking about making that move, like stuff that you wish you had known back then? Or I don't know, maybe just a message that you would want to tell yourself back then.
Well, it's too late now, of course, but I wish I had been trained better in the things that I wanted to do. I wish I had been trained better as a singer, as an actor, as a dancer. I was really only trained as a pianist. And I wish I had been trained how to audition. I wish I had gone to a psychotherapist before I moved to New York and learned more about myself before I came here and recognized some of my faults that have held me back, I think. But hindsight is 20/20. When you're young, you don't know those things.
Hmm. Yeah, well, you mentioned that it's been kind of a rough year for performers in general everywhere. And it hopefully, knock on wood, things are starting to come back online now or at least soon. Is there stuff that you've got in the works, like stuff that you're looking forward to?
Yes, there are things in the works. It has been announced that I am going to make a lip sync of film.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened is that since theater, a lot of nonprofit theater companies weren't able to do live performance, some of them have decided to make films. And there's a theater company called The New Group. that wants to make a lip sync a film, and Chloe Sevigny wants to direct it. And we've been having meetings about this. We've been talking about it. It's making baby steps. Mm-hmm. It's new territory for me. It's new territory for the producers. It's new territory for Chloe, only in as much as that she's never directed a film that's going to be as long as this film. She has directed three short films, but they've announced it. It's on their website as one of their projects. So it's okay for me to speak about it. Mm-hmm. It's not a biopic.
Okay.
And it's not a documentary.
Okay.
It's going to be a film version, but made as a film, not just shot on stage of me performing to a live audience. It's going to be made specifically for film, but it's going to take some of the ideas I use on stage and turn into a film.
I see. Okay.
If someone wants to make a biopic, hey, let's make a deal.
Sounds great.
If someone wants to make a documentary, we can talk about that too.
Well, that's fantastic. It sounds like that's really something to look forward to. I imagine you're keeping busy and adapting the act, which I can only assume is going to need to be different on film than it is on stage.
Well, it's probably going to be a lot of completely different material. Mm-hmm. And it will be very different because a film has to be visual and a stage show can be about words. So it will be very different.
What do you think the young version of you watching the movies back in Mississippi would have thought of having this opportunity to make a film of your work? Like, what do you think that kid would think of this?
Well, like I said, when I was a kid, I perhaps misguidedly wanted to be a movie star. Well, now I may be in a film of my own creation. And by the way, I mentioned earlier that one of the reasons I wanted to work at American Ballet Theater was because I wanted to meet Herbert Ross, who directed The Turning Point, because I thought maybe he'd put me in the movies, right? Mm-hmm. He did try. I did meet him. It took me 17 and a half years to meet Herbert Ross. He did try to get a movie made with me and Whoopi Goldberg. It was going to be the American remake of the Pedro Almodovar film, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Mm. But that did not happen. However, I do have a small part in a ballet film. In 2010, I was in a movie with Natalie Portman called Black Swan.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I play the rehearsal pianist in that.
Okay, yeah.
So I did get to be in a movie that was nominated for Best Picture. But I'm sorry, I never got to work with Herbert Ross. Mm-hmm. But he died, oh dear, when? Around 2000, I guess. So it never happened.
Sure. I guess, I mean, that's the nature of pursuing that kind of thing is that you might reach what you're going after. You might not, but then also it sounds like there's a lot of other adventures that you encountered in your time, you know, performing and creating works in New York and a lot more to come.
Well, in the meantime, you can just go to my YouTube page.
Yeah. So where can folks, if they want to see your work or if they want to connect with you online, where should they go?
Well, my website is lipsynka.com, but you have to spell it correctly. lipsynka.com. And on the website, there's links to my YouTube page, my Facebook page, my Twitter, and my Instagram. And also, because we're all stuck at home, I am teaching piano to whoever wants to take piano lessons. And so there's a link on my website about that as well.
Fantastic.
I have students from all over the country. One of my students is in California. Another one's in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Another one's in Florida. Mm-hmm. One is in Connecticut.
Wow. Well, it's interesting that, like, with all the difficulty of the pandemic, that, you know, unexpected connections between people, like it just people having ways to interact that they weren't anticipating or would not have engaged in otherwise, I guess is one slight silver lining to everything.
Yeah. It's not been a completely horrible time. Of course, there's been a big cost for many people, and we may be paying some kind of cost for years to come, but it's been an interesting time. There's no doubt about that.
That is absolutely true. John, a.k.a. Lipsinka, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks to John for joining me, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards, including a fun care pack in the mail. And check out my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history. That's at youtube.com/mattbaum. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comtech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.